This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
People do need that choice. And our electoral political system, it should have been ended in the Victorian era for Hearst Past Post. It doesn't work for people. So we do need a better way of voting. But until we get there, it's absolutely right that we stand and we campaign, because people want a very different voice in Parliament.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, in the week where we learn about council officials earning big bucks, how this summer's Olympic Games could affect border security, and how housing can damage your health. My name is Simon Finlay. I'm local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council, and I'm joined by my usual accomplices, Robert Boddy, who reports on Medway Council.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
And we'll also be speaking to political editor Paul Francis about the week in Westminster, and our special guest is the Green Party's Stuart Jeffrey. First up is Robert. What's been happening in your world?
Well, I've been looking into health in Medway over the past couple of weeks, and some of the differences between wards is quite stark, with some having life expectancies 10 years shorter than those just a couple miles away.
That's quite a difference. So what's driving that then?
Well, as I learned at the Medway and Swale Social Regeneration Conference, which took place a couple of weeks ago, only 20% of our health is determined by our access to and quality of healthcare. The remaining 80% is affected by environmental factors, where we live, what type of work we do, how much we get paid for it, what we eat, and what our access to green spaces is like. It all adds up. To put this into context, the England average life expectancy for men is 79.2 years. Now, Cookston and Horling and Riverside is the ward with the highest life expectancy for men in Medway at 83.5 years, while Chatham Central and Brompton has the lowest at 73.4, a difference of 10 years. Now, for women, the place you want to live if you want to live longer is Raynham South West, where the average life expectancy is 86 years, and the place with the lowest life expectancy is Watling at 79 years.
Okay, better cancel that move to Watling then. So that's quite a difference. What can be done?
Well, I spoke with Dr. Julian Spinks, a GP who has worked in various wards across Medway over the years, and he says the effect of environmental factors on our health cannot be overstated. He said housing is a really key factor in all this. Old, low-quality housing, densely packed, is a real driver of general ill health, which only makes worse any possible health conditions that might develop along the way. Additionally, he said that factors like the amount of time people have to go to a doctor or awareness of what's available to them are hugely impactful as well. So Chatham Central, for example, shows the lowest prevalence of cancer in Medway. However, deaths of cancer are the highest. Now, this is down to a number of reasons, such as people not having time to go to the GP outside of work. This means that when they do seek treatment, it's often too late to do anything about it. Or maybe English isn't their first language, so they aren't aware or understand what's available to them. But people are taking on these issues, trying to raise awareness and get people to live healthier lives, but also to head off problems earlier to give us a better chance of survival if something does go wrong.
Oh, that's really interesting. Thank you very much, Robert. So, Dan, let's move on to you. What's been happening at borough and district levels?
So I've been looking into the numbers from what's called the Town Hall Rich List by the Taxpayers Alliance, and the debate around it. It's a bit of research released every year since 2007, and it shows the number of staff at every local authority in the country earning over 100 grand, of course, including ones in Kent.
So what are the main takeaways from that then?
So the data covers the 2022 to 23 financial year, because councils release their accounts at about a year's delay if they release them at all. But as you might expect, the biggest earner in the county's local government is David Coburn. He's chief executive of the county council, who made about £219,000 that year, making him the 12th highest earning local government officer in the UK, is, you know, based on the data that's available. The second highest in Kent was the corporate director of adult social care and health at the county council, Richard Smith, who made about £180,000. Unsurprisingly, of all Kent's local authorities, is the biggest. The county council has the most high earners, with 38 staff on a salary of more than £100,000, which, you know, that's way above its closest competitors. Sevenoaks and Folkestone, for example, both only have six staff making over 100 grand. It's important to note, though, that five of Kent's other councils, Dover, Maidstone, Gravesham, Medway and Thanet, haven't published their accounts yet, so we don't know who the high earners at those councils are or how many there are, but yeah, presumably it at least includes their chief executives.
So why did the Taxpayers Alliance publish this data, and what sort of debate has it provoked?
So the Taxpayers Alliance bills themselves as the campaign for lower taxes in a smaller state, but I think it's pretty much fair to describe them as a right-wing pressure group who lobby against higher public spending and taxation. In some of their PR and commentary around this, they've been arguing that these figures show that there's in fact plenty of money sloshing around in local government, and that the financial crisis with councils up and down the country going bust isn't all it's cracked up to be. I think many people, you know, even quite right-wing, conservative and sort of austerely minded local politicians would quibble with that. Local government spending power has been cut by more than a quarter since 2010, and more councils have gone bust in the past few years than in literally decades preceding that. So you could make council bosses work for peanuts and redirect all their salaries into other spending, and it would probably make pretty minimal difference to the overall state of local government finances. I also spoke to Professor Colin Copus. He's a long-standing expert in local government, and he told me that pay for senior council officers is high and has generally been high for very good reason. He pointed out there's pretty much no job anywhere in the private sector that involves such diversity of tasks and such wide responsibility, and that most senior council officers could easily go away and earn significantly more money in business, NGOs or the charity sector. You know, there's scrutiny of pay for local government because people are understandably sceptical of the way that the state spends public money, but changing pay for council bosses isn't really a silver bullet for financial woes of local government.
Okay, that's interesting. Thanks very much, Dan.
So, Simon, what's been going on with you this week?
Well, as summer approaches, the numbers of small boats arriving on the Kent coast or being intercepted in the English Channel is going to be on the rise. And there have been some concerns over how the Olympic Games in July and August in Paris and elsewhere might actually exacerbate the problem further. Security forces such as border officials and police might be deployed elsewhere, leaving the coast exposed and at the mercy of people smugglers. And this comes at a time when the Rwanda bill is likely to have gone through Parliament and will or should act as a deterrent to people taking incredibly perilous journeys on overcrowded boats.
So are local politicians in Kent raising the alarm about this?
Yes. Dover and Deal MP Natalie Elphick is calling for preparations to be made in advance rather than, you know, act in a reactive way, but do it in a proactive way. And she'd like to see British and French security border and border officials on the French beaches, actually on the beaches. And she made the point that when there were riots in France recently, police were taken away from northern France and to be redeployed elsewhere. I mean, France, like everywhere else, has got finite resources. And clearly, with the Olympic Games, security levels are going to be through the roof this summer.
What are people sort of in the security services saying about this?
Well, I spoke to Philip Ingram, who is a former military intelligence agent. He says that the eyes of the world are on France in advance of the Games, and that the intelligence sharing will be intense. So it might even deter the smugglers from their operations.
So obviously the county council has to deal with unaccompanied asylum-seeking children. Have they got the resources for that at the moment?
Well, this is a long-standing issue, and I've reported on this quite extensively in the past year or so. KCC has not had the places to accommodate the number of lone migrant youngsters coming in recent years, and it's not been helped by the fact that there is a national dispersal scheme which hasn't really worked properly. But now the council is opening up to 9 reception centres scattered all over the county where these kids can be looked after before they're sent on their way to other parts of the country to new homes. You might remember the KCC successfully made the case in the High Court that the Home Office wasn't helping the council provide the places for youngsters. And it's not as if KCC has any choice in this. By law, it must take in all lone asylum seekers, but in the past, arguably, wasn't getting the assistance it needed.
So where will these centres for asylum-seeking children be based around Kent? Do we know yet?
Well, as I said earlier, there will be 9, but we know of 5 for sure. Like I said, the other ones are in the pipeline. Ashford, Gravesend, Ash, Faversham and Dartford. And none of them are particularly big, you know, a few dozen at the very most places, and not all of them will be taken. So that really is how the problem's going to be dealt with. Well, that wraps up what's been happening across Kent and Medway this week. So thanks to Robert and Dan for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Next up is political editor Paul Francis with his Westminster Watch. What's been happening? What do you want to kick off with then?
Well, I think the big vote was obviously the smoking ban, which is part of the Rishi Sunak's attempt to create a legacy for himself. But it was also about the Conservative leadership itself. Now, it's worth pointing out there wasn't actually a position where MPs who didn't vote were rebelling because they had a free vote. But nevertheless, having so many Conservative MPs either abstaining or voting against the first stage of the bill was not the best start that the Prime Minister could have hoped for.
It's interesting you talk about the legacy. I mean, Cameron had gay marriage and, Farage had Brexit. It's the one thing that he wants to be able to walk away with having done something.
Yeah. All Prime Ministers are after preserving or creating some kind of legacy so that they can avoid scrutiny over all the rubbish things that they ended up doing. I think his problem is that this is just the first stage of the smoking ban bill, the legislation, and he's going to suffer a few more bruising encounters as it goes through the Commons.
It's interesting that there were nearly 60 rebels, most of them Tories, and 100 abstentions, mostly Tories. What do you read into that?
Well, I think that underlines, doesn't it, exactly why this is an issue which is not just about the smoking ban, but about the Prime Minister's legacy, if you like, and what he leaves behind, which will possibly be a very split, divided Conservative Party.
Were there any local MPs who didn't join the line?
We know of two, and there seems to be a third which about which there's a question mark. But the two who definitely did were the Gravesham MP, Adam Holloway, and the Gillingham MP, Raymond Chishti, who, Adam Holloway is not naturally a loyalist, so in a sense that was not too surprising. Raymond Chishti has previously voted against his government, but I was quite surprised to see his name on the list here.
It seems to be that those who may have abstained or found themselves unexpectedly on business were basically sort of sending a message out that this was kind of not a very conservative piece of legislation, and that people are free to make the bad choices if they want to.
Yeah, that's an important point here, isn't it? It's the freedom to do things as much as the freedom to not have things done to you, as it were. I'll probably explain what I mean by that. But it struck me as slightly odd that they choose a kind of health-related issue, which is going to save the government millions of pounds if it works. And the rebel, in inverted commas, MPs were choosing that. And I could sort of see why smoking is an issue which they would want to tackle because of the huge cost of the NHS. But it's a question of the way you stop. I mean, is the next one, a ban on jammy donuts from Greggs or whatever? that is a little bit of a kind of a flaw, if you like, in the proposals, which might be taken up as the bill proceeds.
Well, the serial rebel of the week has to be Liz Truss.
Yes. What an exciting time she's having at the moment, inflicting her thoughts about her 49 days in Downing Street. I have to say that I've not read it. I've read a lot about people who have read it. And it seems that she's wanting to blame every single other institution, the Conservative Party, for her demise, as it were. It's kind of there's a bit of a blame game going on here.
Is it a blame game, or is she just trying to sell her book?
Well, the book has generated quite a bit of publicity, which I hadn't expected it to, actually, because, most people think that she's done and dusted as a career politician after her fairly hapless spell as Prime Minister. But it's getting a bit of traction.
I thought I'd say something that I found interesting about the book and all the coverage of it is that she's successfully popularised in this country the phrase deep state, which is obviously previously only associated with Donald Trump in America, and the idea that the unelected agencies of the state can have their own have their own agency in a way. Never used to be one conventionally associated with the right or a controversial one, but through introducing that idea into British politics, specifically using the phrase popularised by one Donald Trump, I think she's I think that'll be quite a long-lasting cultural and political legacy of hers that she's managed to bring that phrase over here.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it up because it's a phrase which I have to confess I don't know what it really means. So thanks very much for a cogent explanation.
One thing that kind of remains outstanding is who's going to replace Tracy Crouch as the possible candidate to fight the Chatham and Aylesford at the general election, bearing in mind that although the polls are saying that Labour are on course to win it and win it reasonably comfortably.
In a way, it is a seat which a local first-timer could be considered as a candidate. Now, I've been talking to people about the process, and it seems there might be a little bit of a standoff between the local Conservative Association and the Conservative Central Office about the way in which it's going to be conducted. There is a regulation, I think, that if there's less than 3 months to go before an election, then a Conservative Central Office can present a list of candidates for the local association to consider. Now, as I understand it, the local association is trying to keep its own grip on the process and is resisting any imposition of candidates, which you would expect them to do. Although it's, you're right in a sense, Simon, Tracy Crouch did have a fairly whopping majority. I can't remember, was it 18,000?
Yeah, it was less than 10,000, but it was significantly more than it has been in the past.
Yeah, which is partly because the 2019 election was the Brexit election. But it's a seat which, as you say, Labour could possibly cause an upset in.
OK, Paul, thank you very much indeed for your time this week, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Look forward to it.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
The Greens are on the rise in Kent, and one of the highest profile party members in the county is Stuart Jeffrey, leader of the Greens at Maidstone Borough Council and parliamentary candidate for Maidstone and Moling. And he's here with Dan and me. Welcome, Stuart. How are you?
I'm not too bad. My legs are a bit achy after all the leafleting and door knocking this last few weeks.
Yeah, it's a busy time for you guys, isn't it? Listen, thanks for taking the time out to speak to us today. Could you just tell, to kick off, a little about your journey into politics in Kent? You know, how, when and why you decided to join the Greens?
Oh, crikey. I've been a Green now, I think, for about 40 years. My initial foray into politics, or thoughts about politics, stem back to the Dockyard closing in, I think it was about 79, the announcement came through, and Thatcher, I was at school in Chatham, and it was all sort of big news. So that kind of awoke me a little bit about the role of politics. And yeah, I've kind of been interested ever since. Bit of a hippie in my teenage years, when the Greens were still hippies. We're not hippies anymore. Well, I wish I had the hair. but yes, and I've been a Green through and through, and very active for the last 20 years.
So what is it about the Greens in particular that appeal to you and also appeals to the voters, do you think?
The world has changed and is continuing to change. People are very aware now that the impacts on the environment, the impacts on our sort of social world, the social injustices that are going on are increasing. And they're looking for alternatives. People who really care about, I usually phrase it as people and planet, they care about the environment and the trying to stop the pollution, trying to make sure we save some trees and plant a few more. Simple things like that, but also people who are interested in core social issues, better housing, for example, which I think is fundamental to our message.
Obviously, environmentalism is essentially the core of the Green Party. A while back, you did bring a motion to Maidstone Borough Council, I understand, saying that rivers have rights. What was that all about?
So the rights of nature work is growing across the world. I think there are probably half a dozen nations that have got rights of nature enshrined in their constitution.
Which countries are these?
Ecuador, New Zealand rings a bell, and there's some states in the US as well. Florida, of all places, would you believe, was, I think, the latest place. So there's quite a few large countries that are really interested in this. And basically, it moves us on a bit from human rights, which we're all kind of used to, and saying, actually, you know, nature's got a right to exist and to thrive as well as us. It just changes the discussions in a way that we haven't looked at before. And, you know, hopefully, at some point, this country will follow suit. I brought it in terms of rights of rivers, specifically because there is a rights of rivers campaign going on. And obviously, the rivers are very much in the press around sewage and so forth. And Maidstone in particular, It's got the largest river running through it in the southeast. So, you know, it is really quite a core local issue.
Just before we move on to something else, I mean, you talked about rivers and the problems that were associated with the water companies or the sewage companies, whichever way you want to look at it. I mean, what can the Green Party usefully do about that should you, you know, get a foothold in power?
Well, one of the things we'd like to see is what's termed a river task force. So Maidstone Borough Council, for example, would be setting up a multi-party, multi-agency forum where we take a leading role and say to the Environment Agency, say to Southern Water, actually, you know, you need to start to work together now. And we hold them to account because ultimately it's our area that is suffering. So working with them on something like that, building a plan of action so that we start to free up some of the problem areas within our rivers and start to see some of them cleaned up. That's where I think we can make a bit of a difference. And I've certainly proposed that to the council in the last 6 months, I think it was. And I'd really like to do that in the future if we get a foothold.
Do you think the government should legislate against, you know, there have been some fairly substantial fines against Southern Water, for example, but it doesn't seem to put them off. They're just dumping as much in as they ever were.
I do think their actions are quite criminal. I mean, if it was any other business dumping that much waste into our rivers, there'll be prosecutions and people would be in jail. And I think we're at that sort of level.
So you think that the people running Southern Water should face criminal charges, and if they're found guilty, they should be sent to prison?
I think they should face criminal charges, certainly. If prison's the right thing or not, I don't think it particularly is, but they should face criminal charges for what they're doing. It feels like criminal negligence, corporate negligence of some description.
One of the things that I certainly want to bring up, because three councils in this neck of the woods have switched over to a new waste collection service called Sewers.
I'm vaguely aware.
Yes, I'm sure you are. And as a resident in one of them, I know that my bins haven't been picked up. So you are going to do what? Because you're a couple of weeks away from potentially being in power at Maidstone Borough Council. And I can't see this being sorted out by then necessarily. What would you do on day one?
Well, I've already started. So last week I demanded a meeting with group leaders and the chief executive of the council and said, look, we need to know what's going on. We need to see the action plan. We need to hear the action plan. We need to make sure that measures are being taken, because at the moment we really couldn't see the scale of the problem or the solutions that were being put forward. So I think it's around holding officers and sewers' feet to the fire until things are sorted. My team have put out communications through social media. We're collecting information on the doorstep when we're door knocking, and people are emailing me from across the borough saying we've got a problem in specific areas. And the way it's going to be sorted is by us finding all of these small areas and large areas in some cases of places that have been missed in terms of collections, and ensuring that sewers get them built into their schedules. So it will take another couple of months to get sorted. I don't think it's going to be quick.
Are the call centres working? Are they able to cope with the volume of calls that they're getting?
I'm aware of some problems, certainly online last week, I think, or week before, when things did get a bit overwhelming, as far as I can see.
So what should people do then?
Well, they need to be talking to their councillors.
Directly?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm getting calls, say, from not just my ward, but from across the borough. And it's quietened down a bit now. I think I'm on sort of a handful every day rather than the 20 or 30 I was getting quite regularly a couple of weeks ago. So things do seem to be moving in the right direction. It's certainly not fixed yet.
So on something a bit more electoral, like Simon mentioned, you know, in a couple of weeks, Maidstone Borough Council having an all-out election. The Greens are putting up, you know, 35 candidates out of the 49 seats which are available. And you and, is it Rachel Rodwell, are standing for the Allington and Bridge ward. What do you think your chances are like for the upcoming election?
In my ward, I think they're excellent. I'm already elected in about 50% of it, and we've made sure we're very well known in the new 50%. So I think we'll be fine, and I haven't seen any campaigning from anybody against us. So I'm hopeful. People seem to really appreciate the work and focus that I've been doing. So I think in my ward it's good. In the rest of Maidstone, we're hopeful in, I think I counted up nine different wards where we've come either first or second, or there's a specific issue that puts us in a good place. So the canvassing returns are looking really interesting and really good. Who knows? We're up against mostly Conservatives. So again, they are not as popular this year as they were last year or the year before. So we've kind of got a bit of an interesting playing field. I do hope we're going to be a sizeable party on the council. I'd love us to be the biggest party, and there is a chance we could be the biggest group on the council.
Yeah, like Simon was saying, obviously the Greens have been on a bit of a rise, especially in local government recently. You know, the Greens are in, you know, part of the ruling coalition in Ashford with the Ashford Independents, part of the so-called Rainbow Coalition on Swellborough Council with their committee system. You know, does all that kind of stuff sort of hearten you for, you know, the chances of the Green Party in Maidstone?
Absolutely, and you forgot Folkestone and Hythe.
Of course, yeah. Sorry,
where the leader of the council is a Green. So we are, I think it's about 30 plus councils that we're in administration in, and we have got seven leaders of councils across the country. So yes, it's definitely doable. People like the way we work, the way we communicate, and the key message that we have. So yes, I think it's very possible.
If you end up either in the ruling administration as part of a coalition or the biggest party, one of the big issues in Maidstone at the moment, and I remember very well because I was at a local plan meeting a few weeks ago, is housing. You know, so what kind of stuff would you like to see Greens in charge of Maidstone Borough Council, or, you know, Greens involved in running Maidstone Borough Council do on housing? Because, you know, surely you have to recognise there are housing targets. You know, houses need to be built. There's a housing crisis. You know, what kind of policy do you think the Greens would like to see on that front in Maidstone?
So, yeah, as you well know, I think I probably led the fight against the current local plan, which puts large unaffordable housing across farmland, basically, which is fundamentally wrong. We are very committed to social housing, for housing for social rent in particular, and affordable housing generally. Obviously, brownfield site has to come before greenfield site, so existing developed areas rather than farm and woodland.
So is the solution then, you know, building, you know, essentially mass building of council estates or that kind of thing, or making Maidstone itself more dense rather than sort of spreading out into the countryside?
I mean, ultimately, if you want more homes, you either go up or go out. You either increase the density or you take more land. I mean, they're the two key options. So there is some need to increase the density. And I think that's a good and valid use of land. But I think the key bit is the need on housing is for social rent housing. That's where the real problem is. And that's where the real focus needs to be. I know my party nationally want 150,000 homes for social rent each year. I mean, that translates down to about 500 or so for Maidstone. Currently, there is a plan in place to build 1,000 over the next few years. Well, I think we need to ramp that up, for example. So I want to see well into the hundreds identified or built across the borough. In terms of the local plan, well, the key bit is let's start work on a new one. Don't like the current one. I suspect we're going to be stuck with it. I'm not aware of a route to get out of it. We are stuck with it, most probably. So let's start work on a new plan. That'll take a couple of years, at best case, probably three. And we'll take a lot of my time, I suspect, over that period.
You're also standing for Parliament in the Maidstone and Malling constituency. That used to be called Maidstone and the Weald. It was a pretty big Tory majority. But the boundary's been redrawn, and that's gone from being an ultra-safe Conservative seat to one with question marks over it. The Lib Dems fancy their chances of winning it. Labour has yet to announce a candidate, although I understand that's going to happen very shortly. And you're pretty well known in the patch. Surely you're just getting in the way of a left-of-centre party winning.
Where's the other left of centre party exactly?
Well, the Lib Dems are arguably
are centre right. Labour is centre right, and the Conservatives are hard right. So I think I'm standing on my own in the left. Actually, it's getting quite lonely sometimes.
Okay, at the end of the day, you've got three parties which are of the left, and you have the Conservative Party, and really only one has got a realistic chance of winning. It's either the Labour Party or the Liberal Democrats. Why are you getting in the way? If you could easily sort of...
Because people want to vote for me,
yeah.
And or people want to vote Green. And to be honest, you know, joking aside in terms of any sort of banter between us about whether they are centre-left or centre-right, people do need that choice. And our electoral political system, it should have been ended in the Victorian era for Hearst Past Post. It doesn't work for people. So we do need a better way of voting. But until we get there, it's absolutely right that we stand and we campaign, because people want a very different voice in Parliament. Now, obviously, I probably won't win. I haven't done any canvassing on the parliamentary seat. I expect I will do quite well. And if that means that one of the other parties doesn't win, well, so be it. Maybe they need to have a stronger commitment to democracy, to the environment, to social housing and so forth. If we push them on policies that are key to us, that is a win for me.
Well, the polls look pretty terrible for the Tories presently. Can the Green pick up more than just the odd seat, maybe two?
We are targeting four seats across the country. We are relatively confident in Brighton. We are pretty confident in Bristol. The other two, I think, have got a very good chance. We're not targeting any more. The amount of work that goes into a parliamentary seat is quite incredible. And we do recognise that we've kind of got to build that momentum over the years.
What about sort of vote share? I mean, what would you see as a good vote share? I think it was 2.8 in the last general election. What would you see as a reasonable sort of increase, double that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I would suggest so. We're polling generally 5 to 6% on most of the major polls. That's much higher than I've really known it, other than a few odd spikes. It's been fairly consistent, though, at that sort of plus 5% for some time. And I think that's a really good, that would be a really good result for us. I'd be comfortable with that. Obviously, I'd like to see a 50%, but, you know, it's not going to happen overnight.
Stuart Jeffrey of the Green Party, many thanks for your time today. All the best.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for joining me on this week's podcast. We'll be back next week when Paul will be catching up with Matt Boughton, leader of Tunbridge and Moline Council. And you can follow us on X, formerly Twitter, just search for Kent Politics Podcast. Also, don't forget to tune in to KMTV at 5 p.m. each Friday for their politics show. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.